Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Mona.
You know, Mark, over the last few years, I would say about the last 4 years, it's been quite common to see EB5 investors not going into regional center projects, but rather doing their own projects, both pooled and through regional centers, but with friends and family.
I could see that. That makes sense because they already have a relationship with these people and then are thinking, well, let's go into business together and then get that immigration benefit to the U.S. So, I mean, that makes logical sense. Right?
Yep. The trust element is huge. But what we are seeing now is what happens when relationships go sour.
Well, Mona, can the parties just pack up and go their separate ways?
It's not as straightforward as that, Mark.
I can certainly see how that would be a challenge, Mona. And that's why today on the show, I'm glad that we have joining us Rohit Kapuria. Rohit regularly represents EB5 lenders, EB5 borrowers, banks, regional centers, real estate developers, investors working in direct EB5 projects, as well as migration brokers. He often collaborates with economists, business plan writers, investment managers, and other EB5 professionals. Hey, even a podcaster here. He's worked on over 200 EB5 transactions with combined capital in excess of $5 billion. Rohit, welcome to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
So, Rohit, I know you've worked on some great big deals, but tell me, how many of friends and family cases have you done recently?
Good question, Mona. I was thinking about this last night and going through the numbers, but last I counted, we probably have done 24 or 25 of these friends and family deals.
Yep, and it's going to increase, I feel, with the higher investment amount. Because every other person who calls us wants to work with friends and family. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, there's a cultural element to it on the first hand. So on my end, and I know Mona, for you as well, we regularly represent a number of Indian-based, Indian-born clients, whether they are based in India or they're based in the Gulf or Africa. But there is a trust factor on that cultural element. Why give your capital, your hard-earned capital, to a group that you don't know, versus giving your capital to a group that you do know and have some prior relationship with? That's the common thread of every discussion I've had with these investors.
It's not just Indians, Rohit. We have groups from all over the world who've clubbed together, whether it's from Vietnam or from Europe even. And there are a number of pitfalls. It's not that easy to put your own project, and we've seen that. But amazingly enough, recently, the projects seem to have been going well, but it's the relationships which have been going sour. So we wanted to discuss today, can the parties just pack up and go their separate ways, and or what really happens?
Business divorce.
Yeah, business divorce with an EB5 flavor.
Like an investment immigration prenup.
Absolutely. The difference here, and to pick up on what Mark would use, you have a prenup, but except in our case, we have an operating agreement or we have a limited partnership agreement that we rely on that contemplates these same scenarios.
So here is the thing. Many a time, investors, when they put their own petition together, they do try and cut corners, Rohit, and they will use a boilerplate operating agreement. I don't think we can emphasize enough how important it is to have your corporate documents done correctly.
Absolutely, Mona. It is probably one of the most frustrating things as counsel when a group comes over to me and the first thing they say is, hey, I already have a format I downloaded from Rocket Lawyer, or I have a friend of a friend who is an attorney and they prepared this template and this is what I want to use. And can you give me a discount of X amount because I already have the document done?
No. Well, what kind of things, perhaps, I know you've done many of these, but what kind of things could you include in an operating agreement which would safeguard against, you know, relationships going sour and business divorce, et cetera?
Well, the first thing we want to focus on is management. Typically, one of the reasons why a foreign investor would partner up with a US-based investor is from a management perspective, the foreign investors know what they know, but they know it back home.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily know how to operate the business here in the United States. And so the expectation is the US partner is actually well-versed in these intricacies of the business. As an example, if it's a hospitality product, if it's a restaurant product, whatever the type of asset class is, you have a group that actually knows what they're doing. So core concept of management, how management of the underlying business is done, how decision-making is done, what rights and obligations the manager has to get consent from the foreign-based individual, all of that has to be flowed in and properly documented in the operating agreement.
So here's a scenario for you. So we have a company which is going to make an investment into a project. They're going to make an investment via a loan. And the company is managed by members who are currently overseas completely. They're not U.S. citizens. They're not U.S. lawful residents. They are overseas citizens. And other members of the family are in the same agreement here in the United States. And they fall out with the managers in overseas. Can they oust them? Can they replace them?
They could if the agreement gives them the ability to do so. The problem is if you oust them, you are going to implicate some immigration issues potentially. You are also implicating some corporate issues. And then you have a continuity problem down the line. If they are a franchise, as an example, and they're working with a franchisor, there is likely some obligation that they will have on behalf of the franchisor to advise them of the change. If they have some licensing issues, that is also something that has to be run through the licensor. Or, for example, if they are if they have a liquor license, then the question is who's now on hook and who's responsible. So lots of different factors to consider.
That is if it is that type of project. But if it was just a project whereby they were loaning to another party, and let's flip the tables here. The managers are in the US and the investors are all overseas. Can the investors overseas find someone to take over and get rid of these managers because they're not happy with the way the managers are handling their loan, for example?
If the operating agreement allows for it, yes. Typically, in the scenario of replacement of manager, there are very constrained reasons why you can oust or remove a manager, as the speak is in the operating agreement. Typically, most of that language is going to be centered around some sort of violation of the terms, the operative terms of the agreement, and or fraudulent activity, and or doing something that is not in the interest of the business. If it's simply, we don't like you and we don't get along anymore, that is not going to be sufficient.
Right. Well, let's talk about the immigration side for a second. I know that Senator Grassley's new bill is going to make some changes when it comes to overseas management, but as that hasn't happened yet, and we can talk about that later, what happens as far as EB-5 is concerned if you decide to change the manager, even if it's in the operating agreement? Could that be considered a material change?
Potentially, yes. In the instance we are dealing with a regional center project versus a direct EB-5 project, then there has been ongoing reporting that was done with USCIS on an annual fiscal year basis. And within that document, the I-924A, there was disclosure as to who the manager is slash was. If you make that change between two fiscal year periods without disclosing to USCIS of the change, you potentially could be subject to some sort of immigration pitfall. We are aware that USCIS conducts, as you are, frequent site visits to these various businesses.
Right.
And the last thing you want is a change in management that was not disclosed to USCIS appropriately and which USCIS would deem to be material in nature.
Well, to be material, though, to really make a difference as far as the filing is concerned, wouldn't it have to be something a little more than just disclosure? I'm hearing that, you know, part of me is saying, well, it's only disclosure. Is that not just a letter or an email to USCIS? Is that really a material change?
Well, it depends, right? Because sometimes, I mean, USCIS has kept materiality within its discretion of how it interprets it. And so the language of materiality within the EB-5 policy memo is open to interpretation. What we've noticed over the years is with each case, it's going to be fundamentally unique to that one case. A simple change of management that doesn't impact the ongoing business may not be considered material. However, if the removal of the manager and is deemed to be a key centric focus of what that business is, and if the manager was playing the active role of organizing, maintaining the loan, you know, running the business, USCIS could look at that and say, well, we don't believe that the underlying business is going to perform. So I would say yes and no, but maybe so.
Yeah, well, it is fact dependent. I do agree with you. So here's another scenario. Same issue, friends and family together, and they start fighting with each other. But there's no PPM or any other agreement of that nature because, you know what, they were friends and family, so they said we didn't need a PPM. Do we need a PPM or is an operating agreement enough?
You know, it's interesting. The purpose of a private placement memorandum, confidential private placement memorandum, whatever the terminology is that it's a disclosure document. And it is meant to alert the underlying investors of all the pitfalls of making the investment. I joke regularly with clients that when we prepare a PPM, I'm giving every single case scenario why you should not invest in the business, right? It's every type of risk factor that one could fathom we have to throw in.
Right.
When it comes to friends and family, the argument, many times they're trying to cut costs and they don't want to pay a bunch of money because of, for a 100-page document in PPM because they don't see the value.
Yeah. Many a time we have that argument.
Yeah. And we need it, right? I mean, yeah. So this is not self-serving as attorneys where we're saying, hey, pay us the money to do it. We're doing it for their benefit.
Right.
But what I tell clients is, okay, if it's three or four guys that are all really good friends, they're known to each other, there is no sale of membership interests in a third-party company, they are making that unique investment on their own, then at minimum, what we should consider is preparing a subscription agreement, a detailed subscription agreement with risk factors. And so we're essentially collapsing the terms of what a private placement memorandum would have within the terms of a subscription agreement and have some protective language so that it's disclosed from the very beginning what the risks are to these investors.
That's a great idea. But
in your scenario, if we don't have one and we are going through the business divorce, then what? Well, then we're going to have to rely on the terms of the operating agreement. And particularly in your case, Mona, I think what you and I have seen over the years is these operating agreements themselves are not very good. So if we don't have a PPM, we don't have a subscription agreement with risk factors, we don't have a very detailed operating agreement, then what do we do?
Then do we advise the clients to go to court? Do we go to state court or is it federal court? Because that's when things start becoming very, very messy. And I can tell you right now, we have several cases, unfortunately, or I should say fortunately, the EB-5 part of it is doing really well. It's the fact that the friends and family are fighting and they're all talking about going to court and dividing everything up. And this is before the green card has been issued.
Yeah, that's a challenge, right? If they do go to court, then one important thing they should imagine is USCIS actually keeps check on these items. We've noticed over the years that adjudicators have been regularly looking up the status of the underlying entities. They check to make sure that they're still valid entities. They actually do online court searches.
That's right.
Public record searches.
That's right.
PACER system.
Yeah, they bring it up in RFEs, actually. They bring it up in RFEs and NOIDs. We've seen them. They've gone online. And sometimes they get it wrong, but we know that they're checking.
And so if they do that, well, then that's where you have your immigration mess. They don't have their conditional residency yet, as you're indicating. And so it's not really a smart idea. Maybe they should consider mediation. Typically, mediation is done on a confidential basis. But of course, if the operative documents talk about straight litigation without a requirement for mediation, then we're going to have to deal with it.
So if a group came to you tomorrow, Rohit, and their friends and family, and they said, look, we've just heard your podcast and we've heard everything you have said. We don't have the money to pay for a PPM, and we might consider having the subscription agreement if you explain to us what a subscription agreement is. But explain to us, who should be the managing member? Should it be one of the members of the family, or should it be somebody outside? And what is their role in an EB5 context? How would you answer?
I would prefer to have a third party be the manager for the specific reasons we have just discussed. You want an arbiter who is not tied into the family emotions and is not part of the underlying unique relationship that binds them together, which is that familial collaboration. A third party who gets compensated by virtue of performance and some other detailed nuance of how they make their money on an annual basis. But this third party would be there to break the mold on any tiebreaker. They would be there to arbitrate in the event there's a dispute among the family members. And they would also serve the role of essentially submitting all the documents so that the members of the family may go on and actually just do what they're good at, which we hope is running the business, but with the support of this third party.
Yeah. Well, that's the best in an ideal world. If they could not get an outside person, what would your next suggestion be? Just arrange the documents in such a manner that there is an oversight compliance?
Either oversight, but then we would do it with the operating agreement, right? So typically, if they come in with their rocket lawyer form operating agreement, I throw that out the window and then give them a list of 50 questions. What would we do in the event of someone passing away? What would we do in the event of an individual wanting to redeem their membership shares, or in the event they want to expand the offering, or in the event that the business changes dynamics, or in the event that we're running into bankruptcy? So whatever those elements are, it does have to be detailed. And going back to the original idea that Mark had floated, it serves as a prenup. It documents everything from the very beginning. And if we ever get into the dispute issue, we fall back on the operating agreement.
Another piece of advice from you, Rohit. What about the situation whereby the parties just want to split? And at which point could you safely say that one party could buy out the other?
And before you answer that, Rohit, let me add to that question a little bit. If these relationships start to break down, are there typically right of first refusal clauses written in these agreements? So that way, if a family member wants to bow out, then another family member or current EB5 investor can snap up these shares first before anybody else has an opportunity to get a hold of them?
Certainly, if they have the capital to do so. In most instances, let's assume we have a perfect split, which usually is not the case, but let's just assume for purposes of this hypothetical, you have four members that each have 25%. And then one or two members decide that they want to opt out and they would like to have their shares redeemed for whatever the market value was for those shares. Well, or membership interest rather. So what we would do is we would go to the operative documents. If we have a right of first refusal concept built into the operating document, then we would have to get into evaluation of what those 25 or 50% membership interests would be valued at. The other members who are staying in would certainly, in most instances, want to redeem them and keep it within their control. Bringing in a third party obviously is a wild card. And so it's something that we should consider. But the other question though is, if the redeeming party is staying in for immigration purposes, they will do whatever they can to make sure that they keep the shares. For those that are getting redeemed out, that is a different question from an immigration perspective, as Mona was going into.
Yeah.
The concern there is where these investors are within their immigration process.
That was my point. Yeah, that was my point exactly, Rohit, because one thing I really always like to point out, and I know you're going to second this, is that EB-5 is different from other immigration applications, petitions, even though it is clubbed with immigration, because it's a business first. But at the same time, we have to remember that we have a petition floating. So if your investors want to buy out and they haven't even got their initial approval, they can't do that, can they?
No, they can't.
They have to wait. So do you put that in the documents, that any buyout can only happen at a certain point?
That's a good question. Typically, that is not something we would do on a private transaction, because in most instances, that's something we have not necessarily contemplated. You'd see that more commonly in documents related to a third-party fund or a third-party regional center.
Yeah.
Now, I will caution on this, where it gets really interesting, and we've seen requests for further evidence from USCIS on this point, is whether or not they deem such buyout provisions to be deemed an option. And Mona, you'll recall USCIS in 2019 issued additional guidance on the EB-5 policy memo. I believe it was in the summer, if I remember correctly,
right,
where they were talking about this very issue of what they would deem to be an option and what they would deem not to be an option. I've gone through litigation on this particular issue with the USCIS just because it's a common operating agreement. It tries to address every issue. And then the question comes up of how shares are redeemed. And in this particular scenario, we're dealing here with dispute, but commonly USCIS looks at it as a third-party exit and whether or not that's deemed to be at risk during their two-year sustainment period, which, Mona, you can define what that is for the audience.
Right. So, I mean, I think this is something that people do need to remember again. Yes, where it's a business. Yes, we're doing EB-5, but your money has to remain at risk. And your money has to remain at risk until you file the I-829. And the trouble is, Rohit, is that once upon a time, we could really say, all right, a year and a half for your petition, 2 years for your conditional period, say three and a half years, and then you're getting to your I-829. It's not like that anymore with all these delays. And in a business context, it can throw everything up in the air.
Yeah, unfortunately, USCIS has been everything but consistent on timing and a lot of other things. So you are absolutely correct. The predictability of a typical business outside of all the other variabilities on client business climate, COVID, and all the other elements that may impact the business, USCIS is one large variable here on timing.
Mm. If our group decide to go into a regional center type of, a third-party regional center type of project, most of the time, those documents are well drafted to cover all of these issues. But I have seen some regional center projects where the operating agreement really does lack for want of a better word.
I would love to say that is unique to the drafting capabilities of the underlying council. but we, in every scenario, Mona, we have folks who are trying to cut corners and would rather spend a little bit of money up front in the hopes that things will go well, which is never a good idea.
Rohit, I have another scenario for you. Even if it's a regional center, regional centers often have undesirable members that they might want to get rid of. And secondly, you know, you might have a situation with friends and family that there is one member who is not really someone who's a manager, but he's just a member and he's doing something unsavory that you, the other members just want to get rid of him. You know, the fraud element can hurt the entire project. So it's better to withdraw that member than continue with having that person there and having the fraud element taint the whole project.
Absolutely agree. We've seen scenarios similar to that, Mona, over the years. And fraud can rise to different levels, whether it's on the pool direct, whether it's on regional center. We've been involved, unfortunately, on some SEC investigations, wherein USCIS basically flags an issue, the SEC steps in, and then all of a sudden you've got two government bodies that are investigating the entire food chain.
Yeah.
The regional center gets in trouble. The job creating entity is in trouble. You've got the SEC stepping in to see whether or not issues of shares or membership interests were being done on a fraudulent basis. And that gets really tricky. So what we've always counseled clients with respect to the operating agreements is that we do have that ability on redemption. And so removal of manager, it's a common element where I'd mentioned earlier, fraud or the like being one of the ways in which the members can vote and get consent to remove that person. But it's important to understand, intrinsically here, in fact, that USCIS has jurisdiction over two elements, the regional center and the underlying petitioners, the EB-5 petitioners. The SEC has jurisdiction over the offering documents, the underlying sales of the offering documents, and everything surrounding it. So if you have a fraudulent transaction or you have one individual who is tainting the entire transaction, then not only the investors are in jeopardy with respect to their petitions, but the regional center may also be in jeopardy. So EB-5, it's unique. Trust obviously is important, and it's good to do business with family members to the extent you have a good relationship. But documentation and agreements are everything.
I couldn't agree more, Rohit.
Yeah, Mona, Rohit, as I'm listening to this, I kind of understand how just grabbing a document, grabbing a template from something like Rocket, Zoom, Shield, and all the other different things that basically treat legal advice as commodities. And maybe those templates work for some that are by themselves, not working with others, certainly not tying into other disciplines. But as we know, EB-5 is a mixture of immigration and business. Rohit, as you mentioned, USCIS is dealing with the regional center and the petitioners, while the SEC is dealing with the offering documents and the sales. So I could certainly see how the value of an impartial legal advocate would be just that, an advocate to the petitioners, whether the friends and family are on good terms or looking out in case things break down.
Yeah, Mark, I think it's important to remember, and this may sound a little self-serving, but there is inherent value in retaining experienced counsel. Now, not every attorney is going to be appropriate for an EB-5 transaction. For example, and you know, Mona has a solid following within the EB-5 space. She has a lot of experience with an EB-5. She's done this for many years, spoken on many webinars, entered in many transactions. But there is a value of going to someone like Mona to help with these transactions because she sees the full element of the relationships, the underlying I-526 petitions, the underlying business, the regional center, the timing. And she's involved in leadership on the Invest in the USA, which is a trade body within the industry. But if you don't go to someone like her and you instead pick another law firm and or attorney that is very versed within transactions or very versed within just immigration law in general, but does not have an EB-5 focus, then you may be running into problems because EB-5 is a unique type of non-traditional financing on its own, similar to Opportunity Zone investment, which is also another form of non-traditional financing within the space of real estate. And over the years, I have seen many of these transactions being documented by folks that are not very experienced in EB-5. And when they go through these tricky business divorces, then the documents come to light and all of a sudden realize, okay, they may have addressed the issues of removal of manager, for example, but they weren't privy to the issues of how USCIS interprets redemptions and whether or not that's deemed to be violative of EB-5 law. And so getting a document or start a document from one of these other sources you mentioned, Zoom, Shield, or Rocket Lawyer, those are great platforms for a starter kit, if you will, but you really need an expert who is going to come behind, understand who the groups are, evaluate their business needs, and more importantly, also evaluate what the immigration process will be like. Without that, you may end up in trouble. Hopefully you don't, but you may.
Right. Don't just start, and don't just launch, but you need to land as well.
You know, people come to us often when they are in trouble, if they haven't come to us from the beginning, and we're there to fix things up. But I really want to stress that not all cases end up in trouble, or one should not go in with friends and family. There are many, many, many successes. But for the one time that there could be something which goes wrong, you know, you do need your insurance policy.
Absolutely, Mona. I will echo that. The one thing you know over the years is, as I mentioned earlier, USCIS is anything but consistent.
Yeah,
but what we've learned over the years is how they are adjudicating on the basis of requests for further evidence or notices of intent to deny. That usually gives us a peek behind the curtain of what may be rumbling within the USCIS space with respect to compliance, with respect to their evaluation of how things should be. And so just as we're learning how to deal with that, we are bringing that similar expertise to these investors. And so there is a value in working with council that has that expertise and experience.
Wow, don't we sound just like an infomercial?
Well, I hope we don't sound like an infomercial, Mona. Rohit Kaporia, I want to thank you for bringing your expertise to investors here on EB5 Investment Voice.
Pleasure, Mark. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.